Welcome to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley. Mom isn't with us. Caroline, as most of you know her, I know her as Mom, isn't with us today. Our guest today is Dorothy Wickenden, and she's the author of The Agitators, Three Friends Who Fought for Abolition and Women's Rights. Dorothy is also the New York Times bestselling author of Nothing Daunted, and has been the executive editor of The New Yorker since January 1996. She also writes for the magazine and is the moderator of its weekly podcast, The Political Scene. A former Nyman Fellow at Harvard, Wickenden was national affairs editor at Newsweek from 1993 to 95, and before that was the longtime executive editor at The New Republic. She lives with her husband in Westchester, New York. Welcome to Writer's Voices, Dorothy.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be here.
Now, that is some amazing credentials. And as I was reading The Agitators, I'm thinking, wow, you couldn't have done any of that if you'd lived when they did, could you?
No, that is absolutely true. That's an interesting point that I had never considered. Absolutely not. I mean, women couldn't speak at all, let alone, you know, hold down a job.
Oh, I know. And these three women that you are writing about did some amazing things, but think what they might have done if they'd been born today.
I know, and that I thought about a lot, and it is so heartbreaking to think about, you know, all of the women's lives that are completely lost. And this of course is true for just about every African American, certainly who are descendants of enslaved people. The histories are gone, mostly, unless they were handed down orally. And I just feel it's so important to recapture these chapters of history that formerly were of little or no interest to historians.
Why did you choose these three women? Well, first tell us who they are and then why you chose them to write about.
Okay, so they got together in one town in upstate New York, Auburn, New York, which many people have never heard of. One of them was Martha Coffin Wright, who was a middle class Quaker and mother of six, and at the time, you know, early on, she was really housebound. She was doing her duty as a mother and a wife, and she basically couldn't get out of the house, and that drove her crazy. So that's part of her story, how she broke out of that those constrictions. Her best friend lived around the corner, and that was Frances Seward, who had gotten married at the age of 19 to a slightly older man, not much, William H. Seward, who at the time was a very promising young lawyer, and she had thought that they would spend a nice, quiet life together with their children in Auburn, and he would be basically a local lawyer, as her father essentially had. So that, and it was, she thought her life would continue as lives had continued, you know, in previous generations.
And she even lived in her father's house, right?
She lived in her father's house, you know, not as strange as that would be today, but it was this huge house that he had built. She loved the house. She loved her father. And when she married, he made his approval of the marriage, and your parents had to approve it in that day, in that class. She was an young aristocrat. He approved the marriage on the condition that she and her young husband would live with him in the house until he died, which they both, believe it or not, cheerfully agreed to. So that's where they ostensibly lived. She continued to live there as her husband went on to become the governor of New York, then a United States senator, and then the Secretary of State to Abraham Lincoln. So the third agitator of the title is Harriet Tubman. And Tubman was about 15 years younger than the other two women. And when the book begins, she's still enslaved on the eastern shore of Maryland. And so in the early parts of the book, she's breaking out of slavery, walking alone north to Philadelphia, which she had heard was a place that she could have a free life, which she did. She settled there for a couple of years. She got to know Martha Coffinwright's older sister, Lucretia Mott. She made, basically, Tubman made herself known to all of the abolitionists in Philadelphia because she had begun to think about her Underground Railroad excursions, which we can talk about later. So she got to know Lucretia Mott extremely well. Mott had been an activist for a very long time. She and Tubman became close. And the way the Underground Railroad worked and the abolitionist network worked was trusted names of friends and family were passed along from one person to the next because, of course, they had to hold the secret very tightly and they had to be absolutely trustworthy. So she introduced her sister Martha to Harriet Tubman, and then Martha introduced Harriet Tubman to Frances in Auburn because Auburn is just about in the middle of New York State, and it was an obviously very good place to stop as Harriet Tubman began her extractions from the Eastern Shore and took these passengers, you know, up the East Coast and then across New York State and then off and on into Canada, where they could be truly free. So those are the three.
And, of course, there were other women of significance that were in that circle, too, that they knew that they did things with, and they come up somewhat in the book. You want to just mention a few of their names?
Yes, they do. And so Lucretia Mott, who was Martha's sister, who was 14 years older than Martha, by the time the book begins, she was well along on her crusading activities. And she started, you know, in the even before the 1830s, but by the early 1830s, when the American Anti-Slavery Society, founded by William Lloyd Garrison and various other male abolitionists, got started, Lucretia Mott had been working side by side, not only with people like William Lloyd Garrison, but in Philadelphia with black women who were her close friends and black men whom she socialized with, and that close little group were ostracized by so-called polite society because this was, you know, intermingling of white people and black people was completely, you know, not done. So in 1833, they had hoped, these women had hoped that they would be able to join the American Anti-Slavery Society and work with these men openly, side by side. The society voted not to admit women because it was too outre an idea. And so these women in Philadelphia and in other cities decided, well, we're starting our own anti-slavery societies. And they did. And they modeled their activities on what they had learned from the abolitionists who had already been, you know, active for some time. And they just completely ignored, you know, all of the rules against women speaking in public and obviously advocating the overturning of, you know, sort of the biggest sort of social stigma of all, which was, you know, slavery. And they just absolutely believed that slavery had to be overturned immediately. You know, along the way, they also decided, well, you know what? Women deserve equal rights, too. So they started talking about that as well. And then eventually in 1848, a group of women with Martha Coffinwright and Lucretia Mott and Elizabeth Cady Stanton among them decided to organize the first, you know, women's convention for women's rights.
But it does seem like their focus was more on abolition than on women's rights.
Yes, in the beginning, it absolutely was. But as I say, they began, certainly for Lucretia Mott, that actually, you know, held true sort of throughout her career. Because she was a Quaker, she had a very broad idea of human rights, and she believed they should apply to every human being. However, other women, you know, along the way decided, and Elizabeth Cady Stanton among them, that women's rights, they were going to focus on women's rights. They would absolutely, you know, work with the abolitionists because that was, you know, part of their, a deep part of their beliefs. But They believed that, so Stanton especially believed that women had to advocate on their own for women to have absolutely equal legal rights. She was the daughter of a judge as well, and she basically had learned law, you know, just by going in and reading his law textbooks. I mean, she was really a brilliant woman. And so she thought that the best way for women to achieve rights was to lobby their state legislatures and, you know, eventually Congress and get these laws changed. So there were different factions, and, you know, as along the way, there were, you know, major disagreements and fallings out. But all of these activists were real radicals when it came to the idea of absolute social equality. I mean, it was just very early in the country's history.
But not all of the abolitionists supported women's rights at all. Some of them did, but it was sort of a lesser priority. I'm talking about the men primarily, also even some of the other women. And for some of them, it was like, no, that's against against God and nature.
I know, and also it must be said that not all abolitionists were, you know, they retained a lot of the social prejudices that were just completely, you know, predominant in the time. So they were very courageous in what they did, but many of them didn't actually believe that Black Americans could completely integrate with white Americans. So people like Lucretia Mott and then eventually Martha Coffin Wright and Harriet Tubman and Frances Seward and people like them were way at the radical end of this movement. And when, you know, when the vote was taken in 1833 not to admit women, Garrison himself opposed that vote. He believed that women should be admitted, but the conservative members of that society just thought that was an appalling idea, and that those conservative members of the society broke off in 1840 in a huff when it was decided that women would be allowed to be members of the society.
Oh, for Pete's sake. And the number of compromises that people who were against slavery made to this basically Southern, but, you know, pro-slavery groups throughout our history, it was just one after another after another after another until finally it was obvious that compromise wasn't going to work. And
yes, it was. And each, but, you know, there were all of these, so there were legal compromise, you know, the compromise of 1820 and the compromise of 1850. And the book gets into the compromise of 1850 and just how further that divided Northern Americans and Southern Americans on the issue of slavery. And it was in the 1850s when the North, and with the active help of the abolitionists and the women's rights, you know, crusaders, came to understand that these differences were irreconcilable, and that was a word that William H. Seward used. He was very anti-slavery. He was not as radical as his wife, and that's part of the interesting kind of dynamic of the book. Because he was a politician, and so he still believed that look, this is how Washington works. And in order to get laws passed, you have to be able to get, you know, a majority of your colleagues to vote with you. So Seward was willing to make certain compromises, and this drove the abolitionists, including Francis Seward, completely crazy. And he was friends with he was married to one of them, and then he was friends with so many of them, including Frederick Douglass. And so those abolitionists were constantly writing to him and saying, you have to be more outspoken in Congress, even though he was pretty outspoken. You have to be basically as radical as we are. And then he would write back saying, no, I think you're wrong. You do what you need to do out in the street, from the pulpits, et cetera. You bring, you know, the citizenry along with our beliefs. And then once there are enough of them, then I can get laws passed. But until then, I can't. So you can sort of see it from his perspective.
Yeah. We've had that same thing in more recent years, too. And I'm trying to remember which president had said, you know, make me do this. Maybe it was FDR who said, you know, make me make these changes by changing the citizens' minds.
Yes, and this is, and we are seeing playing out, and people who have read the book have seen it's so revelatory about what we are all, what we've all been experiencing in recent years about, well, what is the citizen, the role of an active citizen? You know, it is not simply to bemoan certain things that are happening in the country. It's to get out there and object. So you see it in some of these today's radical movements like Black Lives Matter. And look at the verdict in the George Floyd case. I mean, this is so these are the kinds of activities that have a long, long history, starting, you know, starting really after the Revolutionary War, but really building up ahead of steam during the 19th century, mid-19th century, when these women were activists.
The I was wondering, okay, so Martha Coffin Wright had a she was Quaker, and she was raised to believe in the equality of all human beings and to be against slavery. Frances Seward didn't really have that same upbringing. What do you think drove her to become so radical?
Yeah, in some ways she's the most fascinating of the three, just because she had so far to go, and it was so unlikely that she would break out and do anything this crazy. And temperamentally too, it wasn't particularly she wasn't really didn't have the kind of sensibility of that Martha had. Martha was just like this. You know, she was just on a tear from birth. She was just an out-and-out rebel, and she's very funny about it along the way. Frances Seward was very recessive. She had health problems. She hated her husband's career. She hated electoral politics. However, she had two kind of epiphanies quite early on. One happened in beginning in 1829, when her sister lived around the corner in Auburn too, and was married to a young man Frances did not like at all, and turned out to be an alcoholic who was beating her sister. And this was so horrifying to Frances. She had read Mary Wollstonecraft and John Stuart Mill and, you know, all of the early people who had advocated natural rights, and Wollstonecraft had written, you know, in no uncertain terms about men who beat up their wives and how women had to get out from under their, you know, iron grip. And she, of course, believed that. But to experience it was something different. And she wrote to her husband, who was away at the time, as he often was. She wrote to Seward that this was so outrageous that women had no legal rights at all. Once you were married, you turned over all of your property, if you had inherited any, and any money you had inherited, to your husband, who could, you know, burn through it all, as her sister's husband did with her inheritance, and he could beat you, you know, to death, basically, and there the legal consequences were, you know, not much. So she wrote to Henry, as she called him, you know, that, you know, why don't women have the right to divorce? Why can't women have the custody of their children if their husband is abusing them? You know, and she said her sister would cross the ocean with her daughter if she could do it, but she couldn't. She would lose everything. So there, that was one revelation. And the second happened a couple of years later in 1835, when Frances took a long trip south with her husband and their young son. And as they made their way into Virginia, she began to see the effects of slavery. The countryside just looked very, you know, like 100 years behind the industrial North. And they stopped one afternoon at a country inn, and they were getting out of their carriage, and they heard the sounds of moaning and weeping, as Frances wrote in her journal. And they saw coming toward them a long line of very young boys, naked, tied by their wrists and led by a long rope by a slave driver who had a whip. and they were sobbing, and he led them to a horse trough to drink, and then to a shed where Frances wrote, they sobbed themselves to sleep. She was very sensitive, and the empathy that she felt for people who were being unjustly treated was very deep. And so she wrote in her journal, slavery, the evil effects are constantly before me. And she returned from that journey an out-and-out abolitionist, and she basically dedicated the rest of her life to doing whatever she could to help overturn slavery.
Was she the one who operated a station on the Underground Railroad, or was that Martha?
Both of them did. So Martha was able to start her Underground Railroad operations around 1840. So that she, because Lucretia Mott served as a model, and this was something that many Quakers just did as a matter of course. And that Frances was unable in 1840 to do the same thing because her father was still alive, and he by that time was a crusty old conservative, and he would never have stood for that. And she, of course, you know, had to follow his rules because he was her father and he owned the house. When he died, she inherited the house and a great deal of property. And eventually the Married Women's Property Act was passed in New York State around 1848. And so she herself did, own this house finally. And her husband and her father had converted their original, the original basement kitchen was empty because they had expanded the house. And so Frances decided really very soon after her father died, well, I'm going to have an Underground Railroad station in my kitchen basement too. And it was empty, and the original dining room was empty. So you can go to the Seward House Museum today and see all of this. And that was my trip where I got this private tour and went down and learned about Frances Seward and how she hid fugitive slaves in her basement kitchen. It was the beginning of the inspiration of this book.
And do you think Harriet Tubman brought fugitives to these two women to hide?
Yes. There's no question. Frances was so discreet that she didn't write in her, and much of this book was constructed through the letters, thank goodness they remained, between Frances Seward and her husband, and then other members of her family, her sister among them, and then Martha's letters to her older sister, Lucretia Mott, and they were both wonderful, vivid correspondence. So the just gem after gem in these letters. So I'm sorry, I've now forgotten your question.
About Harriet Tubman bringing fugitives.
Oh, yes.
To,
so there was no question. Martha was much more open in her letters, and she wrote specifically about Harriet Tubman's final Underground Railroad expedition, where she brought six formerly enslaved people to Martha's house, and Tubman clearly had described their trip vividly, because it's all written down there in Martha's letter, which is just, amazing. And Martha wrote a letter to her daughter Ellen, talking about how Harriet had brought these people all the way from Maryland, and there was a baby, and the mother had to carry the baby the whole time, and they had to spread out an old comforter in the forest. And all of the Harriet's passengers, she hid them while she went out foraging. Just remarkable stuff that you can find in these letters that, you otherwise, would never, would have been lost.
You're listening to Writers' Voices, and our guest today is Dorothy Wickenden, author of The Agitators, Three Friends Who Fought for Abolition and Women's Rights. Now, Dorothy, your other book, Nothing Daunted, was also based on letters. So is that kind of your thing?
Well, it's sort of my thing, which I never in my life expected until 14 years ago or whenever it was, I discovered my grandmother's letters in an old drawer in my desk drawer. I just stuck them in there and never read them before. And those happened to be letters. My grandmother grew up in Auburn, a generation or two after these women, but clearly these women's legacy had lived on in Auburn. My grandmother became, she went to college because at that point women were able to go to college. So she went to Smith College with her best friend, and they came back to Auburn afterward, and they spent 9 years in Auburn just kind of kicking around. They too were, you know, came from quite well-off families, and of course they were expected to marry right away, and they did not. They weren't interested in the local young men. So they attended these ridiculous society luncheons, and they were just bored out of their minds. They were suffragists. They stood on soapboxes, literally, you know, and she said, oh, but nobody was remotely interested. So they went out. Her letters, really, the best parts of her letters came in family letters that she wrote home from the western slope of Colorado. When she and her best friend, Rosamond, who lived, you know, around the corner from her in Auburn, heard that there was an opening for two school teachers in a brand new schoolhouse on the top of a mountain in Colorado. She and her, they were now 9 years out of college, unmarried. They decided, well, this sounds like a much more interesting thing to do. So they applied for the job, and to their amazement, they were actually hired, and they were completely ill-equipped to be teachers. They knew nothing about it. As my grandmother said, absolutely nothing. We were terrified. But they went, and they learned on the job, and the letters home were incredible. So I love those, and when I found them, I told my husband about them, and he's also a journalist, and he said, wow, that's the makings of a great book. But I realized I had to find her friend Rosamond's letters, too, to really round out the story, and it took me a year to find them, and I finally found them in a little museum in western Colorado. There they all were.
How did you find them?
Well, actually, the original, let's see, I'm trying to remember how this worked. I found the originals. Let me correct that. I found the originals because I had spent a summer when I was 18 working for the granddaughter of my grandmother's best friend, Roz, as an au pair. And out in Colorado, because Rosamond's family had settled. Rosamond had married a cowboy she met out in Colorado, and had settled there. So that's where her family, you know, kind of her descendants grew up. So my grandmother, I'm sure she suggested that I go do that, and I did. And I became very friendly with the woman I worked for. And so when I was looking for Rosamond's letter, Rosamond was her grandmother. And so I called her and I said, do you know where these letters might be? And she said, no, but you better, you know, you can ask some of my cousins. And she gave me because she thought that they had inherited all of her grandmother's things. So I called these two cousins, and one of them said, well, I have some of these things, you know, stored in a friend's house in, it was some town, I'm now forgetting, it was Norwalk, Connecticut. And he said, I have no idea what's in those boxes. And I said, well, could I come and look at them? And he said, well, yeah, I guess so. I mean, I'll meet you there. So we did. We met there, and my husband, an investigative journalist, came with me. And then he literally pulled these boxes out of this attic of his friend, and we all started going through them. And my husband, who has this incredible gift for finding things, he taps me on the shoulder, and I unfold this old letter, and it's Rosamond, one of Rosamond's letters. And she had just washed her hair in the mountain stream. I mean, I just couldn't believe it. It was a complete gold mine. And then I had to kind of stay calm and say, these two cousins of my friend in Colorado, would you mind if I borrowed these letters for my book? And they were very kind. And I had just kind of signed a little document. One was a lawyer, and took them away with me. And they were just filled with the most extraordinary things, including a story about the kidnapping of Roz's fiance by a couple of disgruntled miners, because he was his father. This guy's father owned a coal mine in Colorado. So there were newspaper clips of the kidnapping from, you know, newspapers across the country. It was just great stuff. So one of the things I discovered on working on that book was how these, you know, original documents and letters in particular, which are written with such verve and freedom, you know, to people they love and know well, how valuable they can be, and are often just kind of not looked at in the course of historians' biographies.
Now, with the the agitators, of course, Harriet Tubman wasn't writing any letters, but the other two, as you said, had quite a few. Were they hard to find, or were they all pretty available?
They were available because the Seward collection was donated in the early 1850s to the University of Rochester. So those, I wasn't sure whether Frances's letters had survived, so I had to call a curator there. And that was great, too. She said, the curator said, yes, and when they were donated, you know, all of the boxes of Frances's letters were set aside as worthless. So, and of course, the male historians, the biographers of Seward, there was so much to write about his life that they had, you know, little interest in Frances Seward, whom the first biographer described as a neurotic invalid. So Doris Kearns Goodwin and Team of Rivals did publish, you know, little bits of Frances's letters, and understood that she was brilliant, but she too just didn't have time to go through them. So really, I was the first one. I went right up to the University of Rochester, sat down and started reading the originals. And I just thought, wow, this is really, really something. Because, you know, she's writing to one of the most famous statesmen of the 19th century. So, and experiencing everything he experienced, but from her perspective, which had never, you know, been considered before. So that was that too was a treasure hunt and just yielded stuff beyond what I could have imagined. And Martha's letters are at the Sophia Smith Collection, extremely good repository of women's letters. I had been there before because that's where my grandmother's letters are kept now. My mother, a graduate of Smith, had donated them. So I went there too. And in the course of the research, I had to, because I have a full-time job, I had to hire young researchers to help me transcribe, you know, the letters so that I could, you know, get that done while I was doing my day job and then work on the book on the weekends.
I have a trove of family letters too, including letters from a soldier in the Civil War, Iowan. Yeah, writing home. It was my, great-great-grandmother's brother, I think, who was writing to his sister. And he was on a hospital ship outside Vicksburg during the siege. And, you know, there's all these other details in there. And they're fascinating to read. And it's like every scrap of paper is covered with writing, both sides, up the margins and everything, because, you know, they only had a certain amount of paper. The handwriting is gorgeous, but very difficult to read for us.
I know. And it's the same for both of these women. And so my transcribers often would have to, you know, leave blanks. And of course, they sent me copies of the originals. And so I got to know the way the women wrote. And so I was able to fill in almost all of the blanks. And especially Martha, she had this beautiful handwriting and squeezed every single thing she could, and as you say, up the sides, over the and the paper was so thin that you could see, you know, you could see the backside too, so that made it even harder to read.
And if my mother were with us today, she would lament the fact that kids aren't learning cursive anymore.
I know.
So who's going to be able to read these letters 50 years from now?
Well, that is absolutely true. And, you know, people don't write letters at all anymore. So that,
I know. And emails aren't quite the same, are they?
Oh, they're completely different. I mean, there are interesting things to, you know, and all these emails, of course, are being archived somewhere in the cloud. I don't know exactly how, but they're all there. But nothing like, I mean, people had time, you know, in those days to do, and also it was just part of life. There was no TV, you know, there were, you know, you read, and then you, especially women, and because they couldn't speak, they wrote letters, and often, you know, to their sisters, where they kind of cut loose in a way that they couldn't anywhere else. So there's a lot to be found in there about just how much they hated, you know, being relegated to the margins, and why, you know, why it was that they finally decided they had to do something about it.
You know, it's interesting that while women, you know, it was like forbidden for them to speak publicly, and yet some of the most famous orators of that time were women.
Absolutely. Lucretia Mott being one of them. And tragically, she was such a brilliant speaker that she could just do it completely off the cuff. And so a lot of her speeches were never written down and thus not saved. But others, too. Lucy Stone was just one of the first, if not the first, women graduates of a college. She went to Oberlin, which was very early in admitting African Americans and women. And she was a follower of Lucretia Mott, a fantastic speaker, as was Harriet Tubman, as was Sojourner Truth, and a number of other Black women who have been unfairly overlooked by history.
So are you going to rectify that?
You know, people keep asking, what's your next book? And I'm still so absorbed in this one. I have a few, you know, sort of ideas in the back of my mind, but I haven't had time to research them yet to see if there's enough there. And this is going to be a tough act to follow just because there was so much material here that was so, and these women were like, each one in her own way was just such a pistol, you know, they were, and it was just really fun to introduce
like you said,
them to.
You know, a lot of these African-American women were completely overlooked by history. Why do you think it is that we know so much about Harriet Tubman?
Because here's what I finally concluded. Harriet Tubman, as you said, couldn't read or write, probably because of a very serious head injury that she suffered from an overseer who threw an iron weight in it from the counter of a dry goods store, and it hit her in the head, cracked her skull and created, you know, severe neurological issues. All the more remarkable that she was able to do everything she did. But I think that she was consciously set out to create an oral history because of the way she told the stories of her life over and over again to all of her friends in the North. And they were so amazed by her, everything she did, that many of them sat down and transcribed right away things that she had told them. So there are those records. And then she had an early biographer in 1868, a woman from Geneva, New York, a nearby town. And she wrote a not terribly good, very short biography of Tubman. But it contained many of these stories that Tubman had told others. So, and then in some cases, when Tubman took part, so she took part in the sensational rescue of a fugitive slave who had been arrested under the Fugitive Slave Act in Troy, New York. And Harriet Tubman happened to be at town at the time and took this heroic role in the rescue of this slave. Well, of this free man who had once been enslaved and was being taken back, they were trying to take back to slavery in Virginia.
Is that what you called the Jerry rescue?
There were two big rescues.
Okay.
This was the Now rescue, the one in Troy.
Okay.
And it was such a big thing. I mean, just about everybody in town turned out for this confrontation between the people of Troy, and which had a very large abolitionist contingent, and the authorities. And people were amazed when this young, tiny Black woman, you know, put herself in the center of this, and she posed as this elderly woman, and she broke into the building where now was being held. So local newspaper, you know, there are local newspaper accounts of the whole thing. So you can put together some of this stuff from accounts of the time. And then Harriet Tubman, who ended up, amazingly enough, buying a house from Francis Seward in 1859, right before the Civil War broke out, and that's a whole other story. Harriet Tubman she went south during the war. She served for 3 years in Port Royal, South Carolina. And she returned after the war to this house that she had bought from Francis Seward, a mile down the road from the Seward house. And, you know, that she spent 48 years of her life there. So And she continued, maintained her, Frances Seward died early-ish, you know, tragically after the war. Martha lived on for quite a while. And Martha continued writing her letters. And she, every time Harriet Tubman stopped by the house or she stopped by Harriet's house, she would write about it. So all of that is documented.
Ah.
So there are ways, you know, to kind of to piece it together. And so the way I tried to write the story of Harriet Tubman was the way I thought she would want to be remembered. So that's how I did that.
Well,
I
Dorothy,
go ahead.
Why don't you read some from the book? I don't know which section you wanted to read, but I'd love to hear something.
Oh, sure. So I want to read, I think, the part about when Harriet, so a lot of people, everyone in America and elsewhere, know about her amazing Underground Railroad exploits, but those really only took place over 10 years, in the 10 years leading up to the Civil War. So one of my favorite chapters in the book is about how she made her way in 1862, in the spring of 1862, she got permission to go to Union-occupied Port Royal, South Carolina, to help many other volunteers who were working with basically 10,000 people who had just been freed from slavery. And she also got herself known to all the Union officers there, and she became kind of a spy master. So the officers paid her to gather a small group of local men as scouts to determine kind of the changing positions of the Confederates who surrounded the Union army on three sides. And so Harriet, you know, she made herself completely invaluable to these officers. So I thought I'd read a little bit about an expedition in early May 1863, and that, by the way, was 4 months after Lincoln had issued the Emancipation Proclamation. Harriet learned from her scouts that the rebels had withdrawn their heavy cannon and most of their soldiers from the breastworks along the Cumbie River north of Beaufort. She told General David Hunter, who used the information to plan a major raid along the Cumbie River, where some of the largest rice plantations in the country were located. He assigned the expedition to Colonel James Montgomery, who, by the way, was a very radical abolitionist, who asked Harriet and three pilots and scouts she worked with to go with them. She was elated. A 41-year-old woman, once enslaved herself, Harriet had been asked to take part in one of the most ambitious military operations yet in Port Royal. After dark on the night of June 1st, 1863, a contingent of 250 men from the 2nd South Carolina Regiment, and that was, by the way, one of the first two black regiments enlisted in the Union Army, and a company from the 3rd Rhode Island Heavy Artillery set off from Beaufort on three boats. The moon wouldn't begin to rise until midnight, giving them several hours before they would be visible to Confederate pickets. Harriet and the scouts were with Montgomery on the lead vessel, the John Adams, an old ferry boat from Boston, equipped with two Parrott guns and two howitzers. They proceeded up the Beaufort River, entering St. Helena Sound and then the mouth of the Cumbie. The silence was broken only by whispered commands and the chugging of the engines. At dawn, the Adams and the third boat, the Harriet A. Weed, arrived at Fields Point, a sentry lookout where Montgomery ordered a captain and a contingent of troops to go ashore. They drove the rebel pickets inland and kept up a skirmish for most of the day. The Adams and the Weed continued to the Nichols plantation, where the field hands had begun their day. Harriet conveyed the scene to Sarah Bradford, that was her biographer I was mentioning. As the fog rolled off the water and the steamers became visible, some workers rushed to the woods, Harriet said, coming to peer out like startled deer, but most dropped what they were doing in the cabins in the fields and ran toward the dock, grabbing whatever was at hand to take with them. Union skirmishers provided cover for dozens of soldiers whom Montgomery ordered to set fire to barns, rice storehouses, and the plantation house. They opened the rice trunks, the wooden floodgates that controlled the water levels, and ruined the harvest, then destroyed the trunks. Word spread quickly, as Harriet said, that Lincoln's gunboats come to set them free. She told Bradford, here you'd see a woman with a pail on her head, rice a-smoking in it just as she'd taken it from the fire, young one hanging on behind, one hand round her forehead to hold on, the other digging into the rice pot, eating with all its might. Hold of her dress, two or three more, down her back, a bag with a pig in it. One woman brought two pigs, a white one and a black one. We took them all on board. The pigs squealed, the chickens clucked, the babies squalled. Harriet called them the children of Israel coming out of Egypt. She helped them to the rowboats, tearing her skirts on the dense briar patches along the shore. The rowboats quickly filled, and people waded into the water, holding on. To avoid capsizing, the oarsmen beat their hands with the paddles, trying to force them back until the next run. They wouldn't let go, and Montgomery called out, "Moses," that was Tubman's, you know, widespread nickname by then, "Moses, you'll have to sing him a song." She did what she could, improvising lyrics and a melody to generate calm. "Come along, come along, don't be alarmed. Uncle Sam is rich enough to give you all a farm." Harriet, I know, she is just remarkable. Even just that passage, you can see how extraordinary she was. Harriet proceeded on the Adams upriver. The Reed stayed at the Nichols plantation, taking on passengers. At Cumbie Ferry, Montgomery blew the steamer's whistle. A contingent of Montgomery's 2nd South Carolina, that was the black troops, got off the mile-long causeway above the rice fields and advanced in double file toward one of the largest properties, the Hayward Plantation. Totally exposed on the flat, watery stretch, their black skin visible, the men marched forward in formation. Meeting no resistance at the plantation, they torched Hayward's house and outbuildings, crops, rice mills, and cotton warehouses. Hayward escaped, but the troops made off with his horse and saber. Further inland, they spared the Lowndes plantation house and slave quarters, but burned the rice mill and the barns. In the yard, as a few dozen slaves ran toward the landing, a small girl was shot by a rebel. An adult lifted her up and took her along with the others. Montgomery's men gave protection to hundreds from the two plantations as they fled across the causeway to the Adams. A few Confederates fired a field cannon from the base of the causeway, but retreated when the Adams returned fire. The boats, still beyond capacity, couldn't take everyone. William Apthorpe, a captain in the 2nd South Carolina, wrote, "Remembering the treatment that these poor people would suffer for their attempt to escape the Yankees, it was hard to leave them, but it was impossible to take another one, and sadly we swung away from a landing." The boats docked at Beaufort the next morning. Harriet walked through cheering crowds along Bay Street to the Baptist Church with her scouts, the colonel, the troops, and the people they had rescued. Those who couldn't squeeze inside the church stood outside the open doors and down the front steps. Montgomery gave a speech, then everyone sang a spiritual. Harriet, her skirt in tatters, spoke exultantly. Alone in Maryland on her Underground Railroad expedition, she had never been able to rescue more than a dozen people, and most of her groups were far smaller. On the Cumbie River raid, she had helped free more than 750 people. She caused a great sensation, one onlooker said, with her speech of sound sense and real native eloquence. On June 30th, Harriet dictated a letter to her friend Franklin Sanborn, who had become the editor of the Boston Commonwealth. That was an abolitionist newspaper he ran. She had some advice about how to cover the raid. "Don't you think we colored people are entitled to some credit for that exploit under the lead of the great Colonel Montgomery?" Montgomery's black troops, aided by Harriet and her scouts, had weakened the rebels by bringing away, she said sardonically, 756 head of their most valuable livestock, and this too without the loss of a single life on our part, though we had good reason to believe that a number of rebels bit the dust. Harriet herself escorted about 100 men to the local recruitment office. So that was that escapade.
Wow. You know, in those letters that I was telling you about from one of my ancestors, indirect, but he refers to a black regiment from Iowa that I think he was trying to get a posting as an officer with that regiment because, and I did a little research, they didn't allow black officers.
No, they didn't.
So the entire regiment was black. But here's the thing that's really interesting. According to what I found, every single freed black man in Iowa joined up.
Wow, I didn't know that. You know, again, that what you're saying makes the point. And this is in my book tour for Nothing Daunted. People asked me about this again and again, and they were struck by the value of these letters. And so I would tell, and they would say, you know, I've got some family letters, but yours sound really remarkable. And I hope you're either going to do something with them or find a good repository for them so they aren't lost.
I am. Both. I'm planning to do both.
Good.
Yeah. So how much do you think Francis and Martha influenced their husbands versus how much their husbands influenced their thinking, or was it completely mutual?
Well, that's a great question. Martha's husband, David, started out deeply skeptical about women's rights. Martha, you know, way early on, when she basically had to do all of the housework herself, everything, including, there were no sewing machines, including the sewing of her family's clothes. So finally they had enough money to hire a seamstress. And Martha said to David, you know, we should pay her, Miss Soule, as she was called, exactly what you pay the man, you know, who helps you with your outside duties. And he said, well, that's preposterous. That would, you know, upset the entire society. No, you know, how can you say such a thing? And then Martha writes all this in a letter to Lucretia, and she says, and then David went off to hoe his asparagus. He wouldn't hear any more such nonsense. And, you know, here she is in 1840, you know, hundreds of years before finally an equal rights, an Equal Pay Act was passed by Congress. But even today, many women aren't paid what men are paid. So it just shows how far ahead of their time they were. Now, David, it must be said, who was a local lawyer, by the end of her life, she died before he did, he completely recognized how important her work was. And he confessed in a memoir that he wrote for his children and grandchildren, you know, you may have little reason to admire the work I've done in my life, but you have every reason to, you know, completely admire what your mother and grandmother accomplished. And I thought, good for him. You know, he basically forced him to come around and become a women's rights advocate. Now, William H. Seward, it was such an interesting thing because he nominally completely believed in women's rights. He was deeply respectful of Frances. Whenever she was in Washington and he was going to give a speech, or before that in Albany, she would ask him to vet the speeches for him and he would incorporate her suggestions. And he knew, he used her as throughout his career as his conscience. He knew he had to keep listening to her. She kind of kept him on the straight and narrow. She tried to, you know, do not compromise. Do not, you know, be influenced by, you know, these Washingtonians, most of whom were Southerners and, you know, were pro-slavery. And she saw over the years how they did influence him. So she kept at it in these letters. And so I think that she did influence him, you know, up to a point. But he shot back. And the letters are kind of amazing. So in the early part of the war, where Lincoln and Seward, who were completely in tandem on this, they believed exactly the same thing, when they were trying to convince the nation that this was a war to save the Union, not to liberate the slaves, Francis wrote a letter to him and said, you know, Henry, how can you say this when there are 4 million enslaved people? How can, you know, your attempt to hold the country together, which, by the way, you have said it couldn't be held together given the institution of slavery, how can you say that is more important than the freedom of these millions of people? So it's just an amazing dynamic that shows very intimately and strongly how this argument played out, you know, of North and South, and then within families.
You know, I have to admit that I was pretty ignorant about Seward, and I, you know, of course, we all know about Booth attacking Lincoln, assassinating Lincoln. I didn't realize that this was part of a whole conspiracy and that three men were being attacked that night, one of them being Seward. That's just, and he never fully recovered, did he?
He didn't, and it's terrifying to look at his. There were photographs of his of say what had happened in the attack, and he, you know, he basically his whole. Francis describes it in a letter that he his cheek was almost severed completely, you know, from his face, and so it's a miracle he survived. And not only was he attacked, two of his their sons. One of them was, you know, almost didn't survive, was attacked even more severely. His skull was cracked, and it really looked as though he wasn't going to make it. And, of course, medicine at the time was not very advanced. So there are, you know, again, there are family records of all this. Francis's letters, their daughter, Fanny, who was only 21, she was in the room when her father was, when this madman entered with a Bowie knife and a pistol and leaps on the bed and starts attacking her father, who had already been injured. He had been injured in a carriage accident. And so for the second time in 2 weeks, she thought, you know, he was going to be killed. And so she writes about this incredibly vividly and harrowingly in her diary. You know, blood, my skirts were drenched in it. I slipped on the floor. Ah, it is it's Shakespearean. And she cites Macbeth. Ah, it's amazing.
Oh, wow. And I have to wonder if Henry had not suffered, if he had been able to continue as the statesman that he was, if the whole Reconstruction era would have gone better.
Well, here's the thing. He recovered, and he was, I must say, he was a very resilient man.
He
recovered. And so Lincoln was assassinated, as we know, that same night that he was attacked. Seward recovers. And Johnson asks him to stay on as his Secretary of State, and he agrees to do it. And it was horrifying to his friends. I won't completely spoil the ending of the book, but Francis Seward dies not long after the war, and Seward continues. I think if she had survived, she would have, you know, really laid down the law and said, you cannot work for this man. Now, at the beginning of the Johnson administration, even some abolitionists thought he was going to be okay and that he was going to follow Lincoln's policies of Reconstruction. But he was a Southerner. He was from Tennessee. And it turns out he turned out to be, you know, one of the worst presidents, if not the worst, in American history. And he was an out-and-out racist. And he completely changed, of course, Lincoln's plans for reconciliation, for how to bring the nation together again. And the result was, you know, the end of what could have been, you know, a real reconstruction that could have avoided all of what we know happened with Jim Crow. And so I feel if Lincoln had survived,
it would have been completely different. So, Dorothy, we are unfortunately out of time. There is so much more we could unpack here, but listeners, you'll just have to read the book, The Agitators by Dorothy Wickenton. And thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, thank you so much. And since Mother's Day is coming up, I would say that this is, you know, a good, there's so much in the book about mothers and daughters too. It would be a great present.
Absolutely. Thank you, and see you all next week on Writers' Voices.